pocket to the shores of Orange Beach and all points in between. An insider's perspective on Alabama politics. It's the Jeff Poor Show.
I don't think Hank done it this way.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Jeff Poor Show on FM Talk 106.5. Thanks for staying with us on this Wednesday morning. Hour number two begins right now. We're at still at the Alabama State House. We haven't left, but we're here. As the session's winding down, we're usually here on Wednesdays and run through some lawmakers. So in case you wonder why it sounds a little different today, that's why. Big shout out to Scott Stadhagen, the House Majority Leader, for making this room available as he typically does on Wednesdays. Still to come, about a half hour from now, State Representative Jim Carnes. We'll talk about Birmingham Waterworks. That seems to be a very intriguing situation unfolding here in the State House. And it's not necessarily pertinent to our listeners, other than it has really changed what's going on in the State Senate. And then finally, in the 11 o'clock hour, Tuscaloosa lawmaker, I haven't had him on in a long time, State Senator Gerald Allen will join us. That's in the 11 o'clock hour, so make sure you stay tuned for that. But joining us now, it's always a treat, and he's always very gracious and always says yes, unlike a lot of people in this building who run the other way when they see me. But a State Representative Danny Garrett, the chairman of the Education Trust Fund Committee, also from Trustville, joins us now. Representative, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you saying I always say yes, because in the State House, I'm known as the guy that always says no with the budget requests. So I appreciate
like
you
always,
saying that.
Like tell your Senate counterparts, like, they're really good at playing goalkeeper, right? Tells people no. It's yeah. Like you never, I mean, I don't know, like, did you anticipate taking a job like that when Bill Poole left to go work for the governor, and then you assume this role, and so much of the role is just like having to hurt people's feelings and tell them, you know, that's not going to happen.
Well, you know, I was a career chief financial officer. That was pretty much was my career. I remember a person coming in one time and trying to make their pitch on a budget request, and they said, look, I know I'm pulling at your heartstrings. I said, no, you forgot I'm a CFO. I don't have heartstrings.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of like, it's, you know, numbers are numbers. You try to be fair, and, you know, but that's just kind of been my life's work. So,
well, the education budget, I mean, that's always the big thing. It's bigger, three times the size of the general fund. And, you know, people that conceptually you think about, We spend as much resources and time, but money-wise, financially, three times as much as everything else the state does put together on education, and that's like the big focus, and that's why like the primary duty of the education budget. I mean, to me, it seems like an overwhelming task at times.
It really is. It's a huge thing. Of course, a lot of our funding is earmarked by the Constitution, so we have to provide the education funding. We are doing some things in this budget, though, that are pretty transformative, because even though we spend all that money on education, we're not happy with the results we see statewide. So we've been doing some things lately, last several years, to try to move to, you know, school choice. In this budget today that we'll present tomorrow, we're going to move to additional school, a change in a school funding model, which will address some of these needs for us specifically. So we're trying to focus more on outcomes, and you can't do that just by spending money.
Well, we had one of your colleagues, Troy Stubbs, on, who was talking about the changes to the formula with the RAISE Act. The concern in our listening audience, and we can address this, when he changed the formula, are there necessarily winners and losers if you're going to change the way you distribute money? Since the education budget's already kind of growing anyway, there's not really going to be like dollar for dollar any losers, but we're just going to do it this way differently. Like, kind of walk us through that. Why would, say, for example, Baldwin County not stand to lose from the change with the RAISE Act?
Right. So we haven't changed our funding formula in over 30 years. And since that time, most states, in fact, all but five states, have gone to a student needs-based formula. We still use the old archaic resource-based model. I won't go into the technicalities of that, but we don't really allocate money to systems based upon their specific student needs. We had three options when we formed the Joint Commission last year, the budget committees in the House and the Senate, to look at this issue. One was to do nothing, just to continue to do what we're doing. We didn't feel like that was a really good option. The second was to totally gut the foundation program, which is kind of the heart of our education funding, that would have created winners and losers. And that would have created some constitutional amendments. That would have been, you got involved in a lot of local funding issues and whatnot. Felt like that was not really going to happen. So what we chose was a hybrid approach. And basically what we're doing is we're saying that the foundation program, the current funding model, we're not touching. You have that. That's everybody gets what they get. So there's no losers in that regard. But we have an additional pot of money that we've put aside in this education reserve fund that what we wanted to do was do some things for transformative for education. We can help, we can use some of that for school choice. But this is one thing we're going to do is to take a pot of money and put it on top of the foundation program and allocate that money to every district based upon their needs. So a district that has a high percentage of poverty, a high percentage of ELL, a high percentage of special ed, will get additional funding on top of the foundation program. So this is, in essence, money that they're not getting today. So in this budget, we're going to put in additional $166 million on top of the foundation program, but it won't be going to every school equally. It will go to the schools that have those needs. So in some of the more affluent districts, they need more special education funding. In some of the more poor districts, they need poverty, and we have a lot of districts that have a high percentage of ELL that we just basically don't provide any funding for. So this is helping us address the student needs. The foundation program will continue. Everybody will continue to get that. But as this funding grows and the opportunities grow for these student needs, we may have increased funding and more specifically direct that to those systems, not one size fits all.
What did this ESL issue really, you inherited this burden. I mean, it's immigration policy. There's not much you could do about that locally. But when did it start to become like, okay, we as the legislature gotta start doing something different here? When did that first show up on the radar?
Well, the first year that I became budget chair, which was probably 4 years ago, I think it's my fourth year, Representative Jamie Keel, who's in Russellville, Franklin County, had been talking about this on our committee about the ELL issue they had there in Russellville. So he asked me, he said, why don't you come up here one day? So I went up to Russellville and spent a day with him, and my eyes were open because I had not seen what I saw there in other, you know, in my district. So then that took me to other districts, and I began to see really where this issue was a problem. And we just were not addressing it as a state, and there was not enough local resources to address it. So that's how my eyes were open. I'll give a shout out to Representative Keel, and he continues to harp on that issue and as he should. But hopefully with some changes in the federal policy, we'll see that issue mitigated somewhat, but it is an issue today. And even some of the districts where the ELL problem is not necessarily Hispanic language, it's other languages. We have not far from my district is Honda. And so there's a lot of, we have Japanese students. We had two students show up in one of my schools that spoke Mandarin. Well, nobody speaks Mandarin. I mean, you know, that was just and we have to educate those children. So this is a way for us to address it, but it's really more of an issue in the rural areas. And, it's a real issue.
Yeah. You know, you say Franklin County, Marshall County, places like that, where the communities have really, really, really changed. But you still sort of have the same power structure having to grapple with these problems. And, you know, you see it. You see the complexion of Russellville, downtown Russellville change over the years. And, you know, local may not be capable of, finding money or recruiting this type of educator to that locality, right?
Right. So what happened in Russellville, there was the superintendent at the time actually used ESSRA money, which was federal money that came down during, pre-COVID, some of that came down during COVID. But he used some of that money to actually go out and hire Hispanic aides in the classroom. These were moms that were able to work in the classroom. There's also a program where those people like that can work toward a teacher certification, because we need more bilingual teachers.
How well did that work?
Well, it worked well initially. The problem was, he said, you know, eventually my federal money's going to run out and there's no state funding. And that was a problem because it was important because these kids would show up and see their parents didn't speak English. Some of them didn't, you know, but he went to the local church, the Catholic church, and said, I need some help. And so they were able to locally address that issue, but it was a temporary fix because he had to fund that long term. So this will help us address things. And every district is different. So maybe that worked in that situation. Something else may work in a different district, but this will give some flexibility for us to address that. But the good thing with this funding change is that nobody's going to lose. Everybody will gain additional money. It's coming from the reserve fund that we'd set aside, which had built up to over $1 billion. And we're looking, you know, we're limiting our budget growth every year. So the way our projections look, we believe this is a sustainable model and will become more efficient too, I think, as a result of this.
What is the education budget look like years out? I mean, I don't know how far out you're monitoring this. Now, last few years, we've been talking about a downturn and the revenues maybe not being what they are. So every year you got a supplemental. Do you have a sense of, like, kind of what direction we're headed? Is it because we've been growing? Is that sustainable? Obviously, it's not. When do you think that will change?
I think what we're doing is sustainable. You know, we just did over $200 million of tax cuts in the House. We'll see what the Senate's going to do with that. We want to continue to do tax cuts. We want to get more efficient in our spending. A lot of things in the budget this time we didn't appropriate line items to because we found out, you know, through our ACES group, which evaluation services group, which we started in 2019, they've been giving us information. And we found out there are some agencies, some line items in the budget that they were sitting on money they hadn't spent. So we didn't appropriate that money back to them. So we're getting, I think, better and more fine tuned in our budgeting process. But Moody's did a analysis of states and looking at their reserves and looking, modeling recessions and whatnot. And we actually fare pretty well in that regard. We have the Budget Stabilization Reserve, the Rolling Reserve Act, which we're close to tapping out what we can put into that. We can only access that during proration. This other education reserve fund, though, we can access without proration, is how we're funding school choice, how we're funding this new change in the funding model. That fund is part of a waterfall if we have revenue over our budget growth. So our budget growth next year will only be 5.75%. What we're doing, we believe, is sustainable, and I think we're being smart about it. At the end of the day, when all this is said and done, we're going to have probably $1.8 billion in reserves for the Education Reserve Fund and the Rolling Reserve Fund. And then, of course, the Advancement Technology Fund, which we are appropriating over $1 billion out this year, we'll continue to see that model out. So I think we're in really good fiscal shape. Now we can sharpen our pencils and start maybe getting more granular in what we cut and what we evaluate, but we're looking more for, we need to see outcomes improve, and that's our goal in public education.
We have State Representative Danny Garrett with us here just for a few more minutes. You mentioned school choice just now. What is the funding? Maybe there's a big debate among our listeners about the funding and will you continue to fund school choice? What does that picture look like going forward?
Well, it's clear that our citizens want customization, flexibility, and choice when it comes to education. We expected to have about 15,000 students apply for this first round of school choice, the ESAs in the first round. You have to, May 1st is the date that the Department of Revenue has to notify people if they're in or out of this program. We had almost 37,000 applications. Now, maybe not all of those are going to be qualified, but most of them we think are eligible. So we decided that, you know, $100 million, which was our initial appropriation, was based upon 15,000. We need to put more money. So we have actually in this budget are pulling money from the reserve fund to the choice fund to make sure that anyone who applied that qualifies, that's eligible in this first couple of years, will be able to receive their, have an ESA. If to the extent we have money left over, that will revert back to the Education Reserve Fund. What's interesting, we now need to understand the data. What we saw roughly initially about 15,000 of the applicants were in private schools. We saw about 11,000 were in public schools, and we saw about 7,000 or 8,000 were in homeschool. But now, as we're getting the data and the applications are approved, that was the status of the people who were applying. Now, where are those ESAs going? What I'm seeing, and I don't know this is totally accurate at this point, but it looks to me like there are a lot of people who apply in the public schools that are actually going to homeschool, which is interesting. That they would get less money for that, but they're not going to another public school or a private school. Looks like many of them are homeschooling. Now, that's just kind of an initial read of that. But this is going to evolve. We wanted to make sure, though, we had enough funding to take care of anybody who wants to do this. Because the first couple of years, we had this income cap, 300% of the poverty level, which is about 75% of the state. So we're addressing that, and we're going to make sure that anyone who's applied that's eligible will have funding for that.
And last question, and this may be unfair with about a minute or two here. Your counterpart in Senate, Senator Orr, talking about, like, looking at ways to end Alabama's income tax. How doable is that, given, you know, the current tax structure, like having to change the Constitution? You see what Mississippi's doing. You see what Georgia just cut theirs. Tennessee and Florida don't have it. Where do you, how do you kind of try to start picking at that?
Well, yeah. Well, I think that was a comment he made kind of out of a broader conversation. But, right. Yeah, 75% of our education budget comes from income tax. So if we decide to do away with that, that's something we have to wrestle with and grapple with. I think we should look at long-term tax reform. Mississippi is not cutting income tax overnight. They may not cut it for 50 years the way that formula was set up. It's and they're also raising other taxes to offset that. I think we should look hard at tax reform, but what we have different from a lot of states is our Constitution dictates a lot of what we can and cannot do. So a lot of what we would do in that regard, we can't do as a legislature. It would have to be on the ballot through constitutional amendment. And that's a heavy lift. The
powers that be
And here's the thing. If you're going to do something that comprehensive, you got to have the executive branch out in front. So at this point, for us to do that, we're going to have the government leadership and the governor, both chamber leadership of both chambers, and have some comprehensive plan. We should certainly look at it as we go along. I will point out, though, that even though we do have an income tax, when you look at all of our taxes together, we're number 49 in the country. So we're not a high tax state, but we should look at tax reform and seriously consider it. But it's not something we can do with a stroke of a pen or just legislation.
Well, Representative, when things slow down, I'll get you back on and we have a more broader discussion about this stuff. But thanks for hopping on this morning.
Well, I appreciate you being here and what you do. And I listen to you on the way home, your archives. I learn a lot from what you do. So I appreciate you being here. I'm always glad to be with you.
State Representative Danny Garrett, very kind. We got to get a break in here. We'll be right back. This is the Jeff Moore Show on FM Talk 106.5.